it's a jam session. We have all this equipment in the sound lab. So I set up one computer to record, and I said, let me just do what they wanted. Then I went, while they were recording stuff, I was editing the good parts out, play it for them, and made it into a song.
Okay, okay. And the other thing I mentioned was, I think maybe it was not the right way I wrote it, but I meant, you remember I said about reaching people with different sounds, and you said it's not about making music for a certain group of people.
Yes, I remember that.
But I didn't meant reaching people in a way that they like the music. I just meant catch a specific situation and influence those people with music.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember working at the theater for short films. Very interesting. There was some very hard scenes and. First, I made the live music, and I made some very hard sounds for that scene, and people were very shocked. And after a few weeks, I tried to make some other music, some funny music, and I could look into people's faces, and they were like smiling at this specific situation. So that was what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about?
When it comes to audiovisual, sound plays a very big role. That's why sometimes you in American films especially, you see all these senseless music passages and scenes. But it's there to play with the psyche of the audience. It's used as a sociological tool. Like if you put a violent scene on and you put some like elevator music in the background, it makes the scene a little less difficult to watch. Even if it's in slow motion, which is in the case in sometimes in like David Lynch films, the violence is very spread out, with slow motion, rather gory, but then you have something happening in the background musically that is a complete antipathy of the mood exerted from the image. So, like for example, working with Joe at the school, we've produced a band at school, and the process was, he was editing, he does film, he was editing Shangri-La's video, and I was helping him, and I thought, well, you have an idea of what you want, why don't we just put together three girls that can actually sing and then film it, and then you have raw material. And he said, I'm not a producer. And I said, yes you are, as long as you have an idea, even if you're not the one who bring it to complete fruition, the idea is where any producer starts. As I was going to answer your question about reaching people, I understood your question to mean like, are you trying to get a certain key target group? Like, do you want to? Yeah, okay, then that's fine. But I would say, in that respect, I tell all the students at the school that if they have an idea or a vision of something that they would like to do, no matter what it is, then we can come down and try to figure out a way to make it work. Because ultimately, since it's a visual art school, they don't really have a music course per se, so my course doesn't really deal with music. I use music as a soapboard, a place for me to spring from, because I know music very well. But the procedure is the same in any form of arts, whether if you're a chef or a painter or a photographer, you have something that influences you, something that gives you the spark, and you take that thing, the initial moment hopefully, and you compound on it until you've made it hopefully personally your own. And that will make it something that the art world... There was something else that was written, though. It was, you were asking something about the hybrid between art and the art world. That's very vague, because the art world is so multifaceted. And then you have... I mean, there's some people who are perfectly happy with installing other people's shows for their entire career and doing a little bit of art on the side. For some people, that might look like slavery. But ultimately, that's what they like to do. So that helps them remain relevant and inspired. So it shouldn't be looked down upon. Whereas some people need the... Like, if you look at a band, for example, and they have a front person, the job of the band is to make that front person shine and look good. Because that front person is the selling point. Without the front person, you won't have the rest of the band. you know? And it's the same somehow in the art world. There's a few people that stand out. That's why I say the hybrid between art and the art world is bizarre, because art itself is so full-faceted, and the art world is like from, I know, 5-year-old kids who do exhibitions successfully. And then, you know, some 85-year-old people are more relative than some 50-year-old people. And so it's really funny when you say hybrid, because hybrid generally only means two things cross-burgeoning, where art already is a bunch of things cross-burgeoning, a plethora of things, and the art world as well. So you can't really just put them down into two categories. There's so many different ways to skin a cat, you know. And basically, I say to the students at the school that if they don't have an idea, then they shouldn't come to the sound lab, because not while I'm there anyway. You know, maybe they'll get inspired by fooling around with machines or something like that. But I like to really have an idea, a focal point. It could be a color, it could be a lyric, it could be a song, it could be a rhythm, it could be anything. It could even be a sample. It depends. Your inspiration doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be a certain way for you to get the final thing done. Because it's all about the journey. It's not necessarily about the final thing. I mean, the book is really great. I'm sure it would be just as interesting for us to read what wasn't written into the book as well as a form of a study, maybe. And so I try to emphasize that the procedure or the actual journey towards your common goal is...
It's about the process. It's not about starting with a sample.
No, it's about the process. It's really about the learning of the doing the process. You will hopefully learn. The other day, a student came in and he said he wanted to have, he would like to do a piece. He just needs a soundscape, a little sound blurb, of to make his voice sound like he's speaking to you, but underwater. So I was like, okay. He said this at 12. At lunchtime. I said, okay, well, let's wait until after lunch. Give me a couple of hours to think about how the logistics behind doing that. Like, what do we have in the studio that can do that? Do we have plugins? You know, I know we have the microphone and the recording devices. But this post-production is what he really needed, because he wanted to have his voice sound like it was underwater. So I said, okay, when we sat down, do you want it to sound like wavy underwater, or do you want it to sound like bubbly underwater? And he described it. And within 20 minutes, I was able to give him exactly what he was looking for. But that's because he had an idea. You know? And he comes and says, this is the piece, and I want something that goes with it. I'm like, but I didn't create your piece. If you want me to create your soundscape for a piece that I didn't do anything on, then that's something different. But if you come to, like, any producer is going to work easier with somebody who has an idea. And it pretty much is the same if you work as an architect or something. You don't want to work for a client that has no idea about the house that they want to have built. It's the same in the most minuscule things of creativity. It's the same. You know, whether you're building a building or making a cake from scratch, you know. It should be a spark. Did that help anybody with anything?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. That's really good. Yes?
I mentioned, like, I was thinking about the club music is limited. Ich habe so erwähnt, dass Clubmusik eigentlich auf Musik auf einer eingeschränkten Basis ist, weil allein schon diese Struktur vorgegeben ist. You know, the structure of, and you get in comparison to this, you got like jazz music, funk music, and there's no limitation in use or anything.
But there's actually no limitation. I mean, there's no limitation in jazz music either. There isn't any. It's just that most jazz music over the past few decades, or past, let's say, not few decades, the past two decades, is stagnating. They don't innovate. Because if people are influenced by something, the natural reaction is to emulate it. And you see it all the time. How many people did you see walking around looking like Amy Winehouse all of a sudden? You know? It's like people see something they like and they don't want to just acquire it, they want to be it. And that happens even in the creative arts. You know, with music it's the same thing. In dance music, I mean, I'm a classical pianist by training, but I mean, and a master, and I mastered Chopin primarily because I loved the waltzes. Now, excuse me, I say I'm a classical pianist, but I also happen to be a DJ playing mostly dance music. What did I study as a classical pianist? Dance music. Waltzes, mazurkas, polonaise, you know, even a march is danceable. So, what they're talking about with dance music nowadays, they're limiting themselves to something that was pretty much only begun, in, let's say, with the commercial release or the commercial abundance of synthesized instruments, instrumentation. I mean, the synthesizer had been around already for 115 years before the public got a hold of one. It's just they didn't tell us about it. Yeah? So when you see what's happening now in dance music, or when you hear what's happening now in dance music, it's just a poor example of stagnation. There's a lot of innovative artists out there, a lot of innovative dance music. It doesn't fit into the category of dance music per se, but it's got all the same elements. I mean, disco was around for a long time before they had a term to pertain to it. It was all in what was called race records or R&B music, all from the late 50s all the way up through the 70s. Even in the 70s, some disco coexisted with what is known today as R&B music. But on the dance floor, it was the same. So you see, it's not so much what the terms mean. That's why I say categories are limiting, because by the time the categories come into play, all of the stuff that led up to it has been watered down or forgotten.
I would ask if I would have this idea, I would ask how do you expect the structure of the dance floor and if you expect the structure, do you want to change that structure, or is it something that you need for your work, that there is a structure?
I mean, from a sociological standpoint.
For you doing DJing.
Okay, well, DJ, for example, DJing and production are two obviously two very different things. And when it comes to DJing, it's a combination of performance and communication, just like all dance and music is. I mean, it's almost a religious event, actually.
Religious?
Of course it is. It's a very spiritual religious event. I mean, I think that dancing probably oriented from some form of religious state, or not necessarily religion dealing with God or anything like that. I'm talking about like an epiphany of sorts.
Spiritual.
When I talk about trance, I'm not talking about like, you know, Goa trance. I'm talking about trance from like 8,000, 10,000 years ago, Native American, for example, or something like this. This is a completely different form. This is like going into a space. It's almost like meditation. You know, that's what I mean when I say epiphany or religious event. I don't mean, but I did play for the church for 6 years, though. I do understand you. But and that was also an interesting experience to see how the music in a religious context, or let's say in a gospel church context, actually changes the way the people perceive the music. It is very eye-opening. It's a very amazing experience to see that people can get into that form of euphoria just from listening to a repetitive rhythm or tone. Because it's always pretty much the same thing. You know, it's a few chords, like blues, rock, all that stuff. There's a few certain progressions. That's why so many musicians can play together without ever rehearsing. You know, because there's codes, and we can pick them up and anticipate them. No.
No? Why?
Yeah, well, that's improvisation. But to improvise, you have to have a little basic knowledge. It helps anyway. I mean, there are a lot of people who can play, just pick stuff up, they listen. Aretha Franklin is good at that. She listens to a song once, and then she can play it and sing it the second time she's heard it. That's pretty impressive. And there are a lot of musicians like that. I'm not saying there's no formula. That's the whole point. You know, there's no real one way of doing it. And with improvisation, it could be that the group improvising might just be hitting the chord of the soloist that is perfect for him or her to get into. Then it could be a trial and error thing too. But there are there's codifications, because the Western music scale that we use is already been limited. Between an E and an F on a keyboard, there's thousands of tones, but they're just not marked by the Western solfège. That's just not part of our language, musical language anymore in the West. You still hear it in Native Central African music, also a lot in Latin America. You don't hear it in the Balkans already if you go to Albania. Most of their music, their dance music, is written in a 7/8 pentameter. That's not very danceable to us, but somehow they figured it out, and their electronica reflects it. It's pretty amazing, because you wouldn't be able to really sit down with, like, let's say, an electronic producer from Germany, and then one from Albania, and then one from, let's say, Turkey, and put them together doing like the same, with the same programs. I can guarantee you they ended up with three completely different things in meter. And it's nothing more than the feeling of what they've, you know, it's like, the French are really impressive when they talk about artists, because I think a lot of French people don't really know that Serge Gainsbourg was a Russian Jew born in Russia. Because for them, he did his art in France and that made him French. They immediately adopt that, because whatever they had in France helped influence what he put out to the world. So for them, that's French. He's French, because he did it there. If you were to go to France tomorrow and make a name for yourself as an artist, they would consider you as French, even though you've been there for 2 days. I mean, this is all stuff that you can use to analogize towards other stuff. And I don't think that it's specifically geared to any one subject, because it's not. Anybody else want to ask me something or tell me something?
You have experienced now so many music scenes in different countries. Can you tell us more about the DJ scene, the dance floor scene, and maybe the changes of the music scene in the past 2 decades? And maybe especially in the relation between music and technology, what now changes, if music is more free or is it more dependent on technology? What is the changes, what is the progression?
You said ecology. Ecology?
Ecology? How do you mean that?
Did you say music is more dependent on,
I think, technology?
Technology, yeah. No. Music has kind of always been dependent on technology, because man was never satisfied with just beating a drum or hitting a rock or something. So there's like everything that we've had, whether they've been like sitars, guitars, organs, whatever. Every single development procured some form of like apprehension. You know, piano wasn't even accepted when it came out. You know, it was a harmonium, the organ, the harpsichord, and it was like, what is this strange instrument? And it's the same thing that happened when they introduced the teleharmonium in 1885. It was like, it was an instrument that would be as large as this room, and it had 5 monophonic notes. And there was really no way you could ever travel with it or do anything with it. But I find this was really interesting nowadays with technology and music, is that a lot of people are conditioned to believe that they're conditioned to think that they should just go on and forget about the old way of doing things. And I tell you that the result that you get from mixing technical media to produce music is amazing. You see it in film all the time. These films come out, they have a grainy section, they have a part that looks like an old 16mm part, they have a part that looks really crystal clear and new. And if you put all of those things together, you have just a very full-faceted aesthetic that is easier for a group of people to get into. And it's the same with music production. I mean, most of my music production I do in headphones on a PowerBook or in my Mac Mini. But when it comes time to finish mastering, I go into a proper studio and I do everything on 2-inch tape, you know, track by track, and the difference is astounding. I mean, you don't have a turntable here, unfortunately, but my last solo album, if I play the album, or I play a 12-inch single that was produced the way that they do now digitally, the album is 3 times as loud. it doesn't hurt anymore. It's just three times as loud as the pressing that's been done completely digitally. So I would say that if you have the opportunity to produce, you know, get your ideas out fastly digitally, yeah, take it. But when it comes to like making something with some staying power on putting it for the marketplace, don't skimp. Go for the gold. I mean, really sit down with a proper mastering engineer and go for 2-inch tape. Because the difference, master a digital one and master an analog one, and then listen to the difference. You'll feel it. You won't even only hear it. You will feel the difference. I'm not saying that digital is bad. I'm saying digital is great. I mean, most of the stuff on my last album was on a GarageBand, which is a, you know, program that comes with iLife. But the reason why I used that was because 2 years before, Nine Inch Nails did an entire album on the program when it was even more nebulous. So I thought, if he can do an entire album and chart and tour the world with it, why am I looking at it and laughing? You know? And that made me open my mind a little bit. And every step, I mean, I was completely against, in the mid to late 80s, I was completely against sequencers at all costs. You couldn't get me near, you couldn't get a computer in the studio with me. It was impossible.
Why?
I'm a classical pianist by training. It was like I'd write everything, have musicians come in if I couldn't play it myself. But and I'm a multi-instrumentalist, so that was another reason.
And how did you change your mind? How did you change your mind? Why?
I was working with a band, actually, and a rather normal standard band, guitar, bass, drummer, and me on keyboards, and a singer. And the singer had done most of the arrangements for the entire band already, and they sounded pretty authentic. And I was just wondering, well, what did you do exactly? And so I sat down with him, and he showed me, I think it was Pro 24 on an Atari 1040 ST, which is still the tightest machine on the market if you want to get a consumer machine for digital sequencing. It's much tighter than any of the PowerBooks or the computers, even the Towers. And we sat down for about a month, and then I bought the same system and locked myself away for like 6 months, and then I came out deciding that I liked computing. Yeah. It took a while, though. It took a long time. And I wouldn't change it for a thing. I think it's, like I said, a really great way to work, to have the immediacy of digital production for idea gathering. And then you can spend your time post-production. That's another thing. When you spend your time in post-production on these digital mediums, you learn how to apply these plugins and things to other stuff. And if any of you do anything with film, then you have a much richer vocabulary when you talk to your sound guy for putting your sound together later, you know, or even with installation work, you know. But I think that the only future lies in embracing future technologies and not ignoring the technologies that exist, that are still here. As a matter of fact, I think that one of the things that might save the car industry is if they stop producing cars, but just parts. You know? All these cars are going to break down at some point, so they can just stop producing them and just give people the parts because they're obsolete anyway as soon as they get on the market.
Can you see the record, please?
Hmm?
Can you see the record?
It's not a lot to see, I'm afraid. It's not a lot to see. But this one, that was a 12-inch for the same thing. And that was just the LP. It's just vinyl. And this new one, oh, I did recorded vocals in the sound lab at the school. That's on the school's label. I mean, not the school label, but that's in their thing. Yes. Anybody else want to ask me something or tell me something?
I have a question now. You were talking before about the creative process.
Yes.
When creating work as an artist, and that is something that would interest me. How deep does the conceptual planning go for an artist when he creates his work? Is it all pure creative inspiration, or is there a programmatic idea as well? Does he think about how his work will affect the recipients?
Well, I think for everybody it's going to be different, but I would say if there would be a general rule in it, I would say that probably the creative person I mean, for myself, I think that for myself, it's like when I'm creating, I don't think of a certain group of people. I feel as though if I have the idea to put this melody together like this, I'm sure somebody else somewhere on the planet has the exact same idea at the exact same moment. And it's like the next job is to get it presentable and put it out there and see who comes back at me with it. You know, then I can decide, okay, these group of people like this, or that group of people like this, but it's still ultimately while I'm doing it, I can't think about that. Because if I thought about that, then it would be like making a formula, and I'm not really trying to make a formula.
No, I don't really mean that you would target a specific audience or something like that, or a demographic, but it's more like the music itself, whether you think of it as having some sort of inner meaning of a specific sort, or whether it's just a general subconscious process, whether you put conscious concepts into being via the music.
No, I don't. But when something does happen in the composition, which is also a really strange thing with music, because if you're working with a group of people, even if you're doing it by yourself and you're trying to figure out your line, your melody, or whatever, I've noticed that there comes a point when you're doing it that you say, oh my God, what's that? And it happens a lot, and it's like, I don't really know what that is. I couldn't calculate it. But that's when you know, I guess that's that thing they're talking about, that certain je ne sais quoi, you know, they're talking about when they say, that moment of realization. And it's not something that you can necessarily, I think, you know, put your finger on like that. It comes from doing, actually.
So as a result of the process, as an implementation of their muscle.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it comes from actually doing the thing. Because I don't really know of any form of inventor or something that just like wakes up one morning and thinks, oh, I have to make a pen. They were seeing something and they were thinking about it, and then it's like, ah. But whenever you have that moment.
Yeah, that's true, but I think the amount of the specific image that you have in mind when you start working on a project, how precise that image is.
That has to vary.
There's inventors that, you know, just sit down at a workbench and say, okay, what am I going to do with these parts? I'll just put them together and see what comes out. Then there's other people that say, okay, I want to create something that does whatever. I have this specific goal, and towards that goal I'm trying to assemble. Hopefully, I don't really know how to go there, but I know where I want to go.
Try something else as well on the way to that particular goal.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, that's the other thing to be open for.
In art, what always fascinates me is how precise is that plan? How does the artist have a goal? It's like, I have a specific idea, or maybe not that specific, but a general idea of where I want to go. Whether I just sit down and let things flow freely and watch my creativity take me to whatever shore.
I mean, you can do both, obviously. It depends on the mood that you're in when you decide to go for it, you know. There could be something that was said to you earlier in the day that makes you think of a certain image or shape or sound, or it could be completely freeborn. That can happen, I would say. I mean, but I was going to say, when it comes to like creating, I think even the classical masters, a lot of what they did was based in observation or based on an order. Not an order per se, like you have to do this, but like, can you make me a seasonal piece for my, you know, daughter's birthday? You know, or something like that. And then they say, oh, okay, yes. And they think of the daughter, and then they think of little melodies that go with her, and who knows what they come up with. But I think that as an artist, you have to be open to all of that, because it is like picking up on a frequency. And everybody's tuned differently, you know. That's what makes us all so hopefully interesting to each other. But I mean, I couldn't put a finger on one point or the other. I would say that ultimately, as a responsible artist, you should be open to all of that. Like if you're on your journey to go to one particular goal and you find another group that looks interesting, you shouldn't have to say, no, I'm not going to do it. That's the job of somebody who's really focused on just accounting. You know what I mean? Or specifics, whatever they might be. Like, I never specifically considered myself a DJ. I always considered myself a record collector that could play piano and count to four. You know, that was basically it. And so because of that, I ended up doing all this other stuff, and I didn't say no to it, you know. And that means that the journey, wherever I'm going right now, when I get there, is going to be a pretty cool place, you know. I think, anyway. Did I help enlighten anything?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe it could be interesting to ask Joe also.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because he was...
Well, Joe has experience with working with me. Joe, tell them.
How was it?
Or how is it?
How was it coming into the South Lab and start to do a project? Starting doing a project. Doing something with music. I don't know if you normally do awesome music.
Do you normally do music as well, or do you... Oh, give us a brief introduction of what you do exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a filmmaker, and I've been to art school, and I've been making short films for the last 10 years. But the sound has always been really important in the films. So I've been, always interested in sound. But when I approached Eric in the sound studio, I was looking at lots of girl bands from the 1960s and 70s, and there's certain things that I liked about the sound of it and the recording, the sound of the girls' voices and the kind of quality of it. And so we started doing a kind of like cut up of this particular girl band song. And from there we just had kind of conversations about this kind of music. And then from there, we from these kind of conversations, Eric suggested to start a, one of the things to actually start a band, a girl band, from one of the things that we were talking about. And so we kind of chose some girls from the school who thought would be quite into, would be good. One of the girls we heard in, I heard in karaoke, and she had a really nice voice, and we asked her. And all of the girls were quite sort of performative, and we knew that they would be into doing it. So, yeah. I think when we did the first song, we looked at some videos on YouTube, and I played some songs to the girls that I wanted it to sound like, and we kind of went from there. And I wrote some of the lyrics, and then we kind of improvised. Some of it was structured and some of it was improvised. And so there's something that came from having a structure and then kind of being spontaneous and just sort of being together and then watching YouTube clips and playing songs, and then something came from that. Yeah,
we heard some immediate memory parts.
Oh, you heard some? People heard some?
Yeah. So...
Selling t-shirts after the single.
I don't know, the immediate memories, they are... It's a band now of some artists. So how does this influence the way how they perform, for example, or how they sing? Is there really a difference?
There's a difference because they, I think, none of them are real professional singers, right? Maria hasn't really done it a lot yet. She could be. She could very
well. Her voice is amazing.
Her voice is amazing, but I don't think she has she doesn't have the training yet or something. I don't know what it is, but at any rate, the other two are definitely not singers.
Yeah,
they're not. Most performance artists, I don't know what Taslima does, but...
Michelle is the kind of
performance artist, yeah.
woman who loved us gave, she was very...
dominant.
Yeah.
But that's fine. But when I see them working on a song together, what's really funny is they have the tendency to go to the microphone together, which is kind of cool. That's kind of cute. It's just nowadays, I mean, you don't really do that too much. You don't really sing at the same time unless you've been really, really rehearsed. But the way that they fall into place with each other is, it's very natural. But I don't really want to change that because it's not something that you hear. It almost sounds like they're structuring the song but the song is structured already. But it sounds like they're still putting it together. But there's already hooks in it, you know, so it is together in that respect. And it's accessible.
Yeah, and somehow they are thinking about their observations. So, and that's something artists are doing.
Mm-hmm.
They get an idea from observing.
Yeah.
And that's what they put into the song as well.
I hope so. I mean, that's what basically all my lyrics are like that. Every one of them. Yeah, it's dance music, but it's not shallow. You know, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah. But are you then also part of Stars of Städel?
Or yeah.
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 Of course he is.
The Stars of Städel is anyway a student.
They call it the Stars of Städel because basically if they've had time to come down there to do anything next to studying with Mark Lakey and Michel Kreber and whoever else, then it's kind of a luxury, so they are kind of stars, you know.
Okay, because of the stars they're working with?
Well, no. Because if they actually have time to do something outside of what they actually do, their actual curriculum, their actual study at the school,
yeah.
It does make them kind of a star because they stand out. That was the reasoning behind the name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the stars, yeah, could you say more about this? Because some of the students are really, they are awesome musicians, like Jonathan.
Yeah, there's a lot of really great musicians. One student the other day, he gave me a CD of piano works, I think 5 pieces about... I think the longest one was about 15 minutes long. And it's thoroughly, completely improvised. And he has no musical training whatsoever, but it's absolutely beautiful. I've heard much worse from accomplished pianists. You know, then Jonathan Breuer was an accomplished jazz pianist who was studying painting. And I mean, as you've seen the paintings. His work is amazing. I have one in the studio now. He could be teaching at the school as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And then there's also Una, who's been working with us for doing some like spoken word stuff, more Dada-esque. And she showed me her showreel as an actress. She's not even 25 yet, and her showreel, it's amazing. She's a great actress.
Of an actor,
yes. I don't know which one. I have no idea. But yeah, there's a lot of hidden talent at the school. Yeah, a lot, yeah.
And
we're doing an album, too.
Yeah.
We're doing the LP. Should be, I guess we should send out the test pressing this week.
Okay.
And for the mastering.
And are you testing these pieces or tracks?
I play a lot of this stuff in my room when I DJ in places. Some of the more clubby-oriented stuff I'll play out.
Yeah.
I was in L.A. doing a soundscape for one of the students in March. And we had a party after the opening. And I was playing, and about 5 or 6 of the students that were at the school last summer for the workshop that I did, they were there at the party, and they were like, wow, this song is really good. So yeah, it should be, you did it. All of you were in the room when you were here. They didn't know it was them.
So you
did
record it?
Well, I mean, I just fixed it so it didn't sound so cheap, you know, it made it sound like a club record. Yeah, I mastered it. And they were like, wow, that's the first session that we did together. And they didn't recognize it. But that happens a lot with people I produce. They don't recognize themselves afterwards, but they like themselves. It's good. That's the most important, to make the artist feel as though they've actually done something that they can live with for the rest of their lives. Because once you put that stuff out, you can't change it. You know, so you might as well be as bitchy as you have to be to get it the way you want it, when you want it. Because once it's out there, there's nothing you can do about it. especially not nowadays with all this digital shit going on. It's like, as soon as you put anything anywhere, it's gone. So you better put it out when you're really sure that you can live with it like that for the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah, but artists or art students are very aware of putting things into the public. So maybe then you're really in the right...
Yes, they're very aware of it, but I don't think they're aware of the protective, of the something they can do to protect their interests with it. Especially when they're working with music. The funniest thing is that there's so much music on this planet that's been done in contemporary times that has been done by art students. You know, internationally famous. Let's start with like Laurie Anderson, for example, or David Bowie, or Roxy Music. They're all, yeah, Talking Heads as well. All of them. Chicks on Speed, all of them. They're all from art schools. And the few of them learned the lesson of like the protective services for like media arts, and a few of them didn't. And the ones that didn't are the ones that are suffering today. But the ones that did are the ones that still have face today. And you'll see them, you'll see the difference.
Are there some more questions? I thought some. You had like 20.
He wrote most of his in the email in the white space.
And the DVD that I got from you.
That was
also regarding the DVD, I was asking, why have you decided to bring out a DVD and not just a CD like normally? Why have you decided to put images to the music?
Well, the thing was, the images existed already, and I soundscaped the music according to the images. The images came first. That was actually an installation in Los Angeles at the Richard Tejas Gallery. And the installation is based on film loops that Carter Pandian had been collecting over the past, let's say, 8 to 10 years on 16mm film. And so then he edited it all digitally, of course. But he wanted to have a soundtrack. He didn't want to have like a drone or like some, you know, really, really too experimental music-y thing. And so when we met in January 1st this year, we were in LA for a few hours together, and I was said, if it's going to be at the Richard Tejas Gallery, we have to embellish it somehow. Because it was at Art Space LA first. It was his thesis piece. And Richard came to see it 3 times, and he really liked it. And we thought that if we were going to do an opening at the Richard Tejas Gallery, it would be in August or September. But he said in December, he wants it in March. So all of a sudden, we had a lot of work to do. And he's in Los Angeles, and I was here at the school. So we went back and forth, like, you know, mixing and talking on the phone. What do you think of this piece? Okay, no, okay, you don't think, okay. And I'm looking at the image, he's sending me like little shorts of the movie all the time. And oh my goodness, it was really, really hard to do, but we did it. And then we sat down and we said, well, how can we catalog this show? Because there's really nothing, unless you're there to experience the installation, there's nothing to get out of it, really. And so we decided to do the DVD instead of a catalog. Mm-hmm. So that was the reason why that happened. And I think it's a lot more fun for people, too, because there's been a large influx lately of, like, there's a friend of mine in Paris who has a TV station called Souvenirs from the Earth. And basically, it's just, like, images and pictures. And sometimes it looks like the TV's not even moving. But then you see, like, if you watch it long enough, you see there is some color changing or something like that. It's very strange. And so they need soundscapes for this stuff, because a lot of the people that make this video art never put soundtracks to it. So I kind of got myself my foot in the door, like, supplying them with, like, kind of ambient, slower stuff. And I thought, well, it would be a lot easier if people made this already. So I talked to Karthik, and now we have that on heavy rotation on this station worldwide now. And there's another person in New York called Eyewash, and they did the same thing, live visuals for public events, whether they be club, whether they be restaurant openings, fashion shows, whatever. And they make DVDs of their thing, and it's basically like eye candy and ear candy. They try to get as much original music as possible to avoid the licensing troubles. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, that shouldn't be a problem with everybody and their brother doing something, you know. And they distribute these DVDs. And the funniest thing is, most of their customers are like clothing stores and other public venues. Mm-hmm. and they're making this in public venues, and then they're able to turn around and find a market in public venues for it. I think that's brilliant. You know, that's really cornering a niche market. And so that's what I was thinking of with the DVD, because a CD, I mean, there's no mystery, and we could be copying CDs right now while we're chit-chatting. But, you know, if you put something on a DVD, or some kind of a little, if you give people something that they really package it nicely, they'll buy it. It'd be less people queuing up to buy a regular CD for 15 euro, but if you just put the same CD in a box set with a picture book for 150, you have like three times as many people buying it. So in the long run, you manufacture less, and you still make back your initial input. You know?
Because it first sounded to me like the proportion between music and images are pretty the same, but now you're saying that images are actually dominating the music.
In that particular piece, it's the other way around, because I really wanted to give something. He had actually asked me to connect him with a DJ or like a producer that would do some kind of like a minimal techno-y type soundscape for his piece. And I had given him five or six email addresses, and nobody wrote him back. And so I said, exactly what do you need? Because I felt really bad that nobody wrote him back. So I did it. Just out of, because I mean, I have lots of minimal. I don't play minimal, per se, but I have tons of it. Because I get all the promos, yeah? So I figured, okay, I'll just go through it with him over the phone. I said, you like this piece? You like this piece? What do you like? And it was easy, because actually most of the stuff he liked was from the label that I'm signed to. So it was no licensing trouble. You know, which is also a refreshing thing, because I talked to the artist, and when they were described what the project was, they were so happy that it wasn't a regular club compilation. You know, that they were like, oh yeah, great, fine, don't even tell the label, don't tell the label. That's nice. Yeah. And that you could say is some kind of a hybrid of the sociology of art, because Karthik was not a student of mine. Karthik Pandian from the DVD. He was not a student of mine, but he was hanging out in the sound lab every now and again. At the end of the summer, he came up and asked me to do this. And he does installation art, and I'm pretty much, you know, a musician. But that was us. We don't even really know each other that well. And we were able to put this project together. I know we're both happy with it. You know, so there's a bit of a sociological hybrid for you, if you would like to say. Coming from different genres or places, coming together to make a common goal. Yeah?
Yeah.
I have a question. You talked about when a piece is ready, you have to put it out to get the feedback later when you talk with them. And I just want to know how important this part, because you talked about process, and that's the very important thing of all the creative process, creative work. But how the feedback affects you and your work when you get out? Generally artists, but especially you.
I think that myself, I don't really care so much, because I've had a few careers already. Like, by the time I was 10, I was a classical piano
mastery, and I did church piano for like 6 years, and I started DJing. So I didn't start producing or writing my own music. I wrote music when I was a teenager, but I didn't really play it for anybody. As a matter of fact, there's some of the stuff on that album that I wrote when I was a teenager, and I just didn't, you know, since it's been laying around, I figured, well, hell, might as well, it's like money in the bank, isn't it? But ultimately, like I was saying to you, this really is the process. And it took me a long time to realize that going through the process was the actual cookie. You know, that was the actual goal, to actually get through it, you know. And so I look at most forms of creativity as therapy, because you would probably feel terrible if you had an idea in your head and you never brought it out. Over a longer period of time, it's going to eat you up. You know, and you want to bring it out. You have to bring it out to some, either to yourself or to your immediate, like, circle of friends, maybe. But ultimately, what they think about it, since they don't know the procedure, unless they do know it, but if they don't know the procedure, it doesn't really make any difference what they think. Do they enjoy it or not? Because now the thing is going to inspire them to do something else that you'll never know anything about. You know, and like I have a friend of mine, he had just started his MySpace page very late in his career. And he was like saying, all these people writing me that I don't, you know, why are they writing me? I said, do you know who bought your records over the past 20 years? Do you see their faces? Do you see their names in your mailbox? Like you're literally in your physical mailbox at home? No, it's no different with this. You know, and it's like once it's out there, it's hopefully going to be something that somebody else can either learn from, enjoy, hate. It doesn't make any difference because if they want, no matter what they're saying about you, they're saying you're a piece of shit, or they say they love you, they're still talking about you. So ultimately, it doesn't make any difference, does it?
Yeah.
You know.
So the important thing is to make the peace part of the whole discourse, to become an inspiration, maybe.
Yeah, because you were inspired to do it. So you can only hope that by you being inspired to do something, that somebody will pick up on the energy that you use to produce it and make it and be inspired to do something else. It's just like, you know, it's like playing the track race. You know, it's always going to be somebody else to take the stick. And that's what I was saying, like once you put that thing out there, you better hope you like it, because it's going to be there for the rest of your life. It's going to be a reference that everybody's going to make towards you. So if that's something that you really don't like, then you shouldn't put it out there if you're that sensitive, you know. But I mean, ultimately, like I said, it's really, I mean, the goal for me is always to have an experience that I can learn from, be able to share with people about. And hopefully that if they didn't have this moment, if they pick up one of these things and hear some of this stuff, that they would be able to say, wow, that's pretty, I want to try to do a little bit differently, maybe my own thing, or do something like, but you know, personalize it, you know, because copying something or copying somebody is the highest form of praise you can get. I mean, it's really a compliment, like you can't imagine. It hurts, but it's a great compliment. If somebody steals your stuff and then you see them working with it, it's like, God damn it. You know, but at the same time, you can't really hate on them because you did something that inspired them to do that. They know. Even if they are in denial about it, they will always know for their entire life. You know, and so you can live with that little vignette, you know.
And how is it as a DJ? Because from the DJs I know, because it's this communication situation that I don't know, maybe you are more dependent on the feedback of the public, because you have to see how the people react, how they dance. Is there another situation?
That's interesting. Let me stop you for a second.
There's something interesting about that. I just thought about it now. It's the sociology of this whole DJing thing. When I started DJing, if you were a DJ in the room, a disc jockey in the room, it pretty much meant that you were only there as entertainment. And if you were a disc jockey in a club situation, you never saw the DJ. You didn't even know where the DJ booth was. You'd go to the club, you might know who the DJ is from knowing somebody else who knew the club owner or security or somebody, and they might be able to take you where the DJ was, but there was a whole room separate from the entire club where the DJ was. And sometimes they even had different entrances for the DJ. And it wasn't a star system. It was because it's a job. And they look at it as something that you don't mess with that person, because that person is concentrating making sure that people stay in your place drinking. And if that person, if the light guy walks out, well, nobody's going to stop dancing because there's no lights on the dance floor. You know what I mean? Well, you can stop the music and you're going to have an angry crowd of people. You know, and so they pretty much set the DJ up in his own room with his own sound system. You had your sound system that you could hear what was playing on the dance floor. You had another sound system so you could hear what you were getting ready to play in the room. And I never even used headphones. We would mix in the room with the two sound systems. You see, and all of this DJ in the center of a room or like on a podium, like in a church on a certain, you know, all that stuff is, that's all that rave culture thing. And that's something that I still am not very warm with. Sometimes I play these large venues and it's like that, you know, everybody's standing there looking. I mean, when the DJ is working, there's nothing to see. There's really nothing to see. There's absolutely no attraction there. The attraction should be on the dance floor next to you, within reaching distance. You know, that should be your attraction to be in that place. And I mean, the whole thing about the we're coming to you in a second. The whole sociological point of that is that it makes people think that they should be elated, but they're not really paying attention to what's happening in the room. I mean, you see it all the time. You go to a concert, nobody's watching it. They're watching it with their phone. You know, it's.
But you play different music if you're in different spaces, or you think, okay, there are this kind of people, so I play this kind of music. Maybe you can do your own stuff if you're like a resident DJ somewhere, but if you are invited, you look, okay, what kind of club is it, what kind of music I'm going to play, or you do it for the people there, or.
Well, it depends on how big your fan base is and how long you've been doing it. You know, I mean, if you are somebody who has,
you're some sort of a resident.
Right, that's my point. And it's like, if you've got the experience, you're going to be big, because you can't play the same genre of music for 27 years, in my case. You know, it'd be impossible. But I can honestly say this much, I have records that I bought 25 years ago that are still in my collection, that I still play today, that people still think just came out yesterday. So ultimately, no, the people are going to follow you, because there's too many of them. And when there's one person in front, then people generally follow him anyway. So it's up to you to lead them out of their mediocrity, or out of their knowledge of the everyday. I tell people all the time, one woman came up to me once in a club, I don't remember, we were probably in Munich or someplace, and she's like, I don't like the music. I was like, okay, well, let me explain to you like this. I'm paid to be here, you paid to just get in, all right? So here's five or we'll take a taxi and go home, all right? Same girl came to me at the end of the night and said she didn't know a single song I played and she loved it all night long, all right, and gave me my five euro back. But she kept it. She kept it just long enough to see if she was going to like the music, and if it was good, she came back and gave me my five euro back. So there's something saying in that, you know what I mean? It's like, I don't take requests when I DJ, just because, okay, if I'm doing a DJ at a wedding, it's different. But if I'm hired to go to a club or something like that, then I'm sorry. No, it's not a wedding, you know. Those are very special things, like weddings and family parties, that's a completely different thing. I wouldn't even consider that DJing. You know, that's fun more so, because you don't really have to work that hard. But in a place where you know nobody, and you've never been before, and they're booking you because maybe you sold some record, those people are usually going to be in for a surprise. And it can be pleasant or it can be unpleasant, depending on how you take it. You know, and to keep it pleasant, I usually tell places that I've never been before, I tell them to pay me up front, just to make sure everybody's happy at the end of the night. It helps. Yeah?
And if you go home, back to your club where it started, it's just the same people everywhere, but where you make it.
There's very few of them that are still open. I mean, I've been DJing for 28 years now. 27, 28 years, yeah. So most of the clubs that I was working in, except for maybe a couple in San Francisco, are all closed down. Worldwide. You know, I mean, the club itself, like physical clubs, they seem to either be like family owned and they last forever, or they have like a running time of about 5 to 8 years, 5 to 8, maybe 15 years, if they're really, really good. 15 years is the longest I know of. But then those are like the ones that keep adapting. They change their style. Like one week they're a rock club, the next week they're a soul club, the next week they're independent. You know, those kind of clubs, they usually stay around for a while. But the specific ones, the buildings and the licenses stay the same, but the owners change frequently. They go in and out so fast. In some clubs, like you can't change the name either if the license has been issued. There's some clubs that have had a liquor license issued like in the 20s, and it's not allowed for their name to be changed. But I can guarantee you the owner hasn't been the same since then. You know? Yeah?
I've got another question. You said you don't really like when you're DJing that you are like in this rave culture in the middle of the room, but don't you enjoy it to be not in an extra room, just to feel the mood of the people? Or
No,
I find that it's much easier as a
music selector when you don't have the distraction of the room. You can go out every now and then and see what's going on. You don't have to stay in your little hovel the whole time. But I mean, ultimately, what happens when you're in the set, in the room with the people, it always happens. Somebody's going to come up and want to talk to you, or it's just, and it breaks your concentration. It might not seem like much to somebody who doesn't do it, but DJing does take a certain level of concentration. And if that concentration is even broke once, it can screw up the next three mixes. You know? And that's a pain in the ass, I'm sorry. That's something I would rather avoid. I'd rather, it's like, my point is, it's like, I don't bother you in your office, don't bother me in mine. You know what I mean? Once we're finished, we're going to hang out. Once I'm finished, we're going to hang out at the bar and drink and everything. But while I'm working, please, if you want to enjoy yourself, let me work. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
I think maybe some DJs don't think like that because they don't have the experience, maybe. There's a different time period as well. You know? It's like, I don't even know what kind of music I play, honestly. It's so diverse. It's all danceable, but it doesn't fit into any particular genre. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's like, there's more than one way to skin a cat. You know, at the end of the day, you've got your violin strings. You know, you don't know exactly how they got there, but hey, you can play the violin now, you know. And so there's a million and one ways to skin a cat, that's all I can say.
Yeah, I thought maybe it's a good feeling how you see directly the people dancing and...
That I like when I'm doing a live show. If I'm doing one of my DJ live sets, where it's like a keyboard, microphone, turntables, drum machine, then I like it. But if I'm actually just going to the club to DJ on like a regular night, I kind of don't really want to communicate too much. I mean, it's like when you go to work, regular work. I mean, you don't spend 90% of your time chit-chatting with your cubicle partner, you know what I mean? You have a few things that you have to concentrate on. And unfortunately, in a club situation where most people are only there for loisir, meaning for fun, free time, and you're actually there to pay the rent and have a good time, it's like you've got the balance, but they don't. They're too far off on the other side, you know what I mean? So they're all like drunk and falling all over you. Hey, I love you really. That's wonderful. I love you too, but can you love me later? You know what I mean, right?
Yeah, okay.
That's why I say for everybody it's kind of different. I mean, personally, I prefer to be kind of left alone for at least a good hour and a half, just to get the thing going. But, I mean, I can understand why some people like the social aspect of it. I think that's where a lot of this, like, DJing on Power Books is headed. It's like, this is the closest thing that some of those, I mean, I have one partner, I won't say any names, but my God, he's DJing on his Power Book. Everything's coming out of his Power Book. At the same time, he's like, you know, short messaging on Facebook and buying records. Downloading records all at the same time. And I mean, this is somebody who has over 22,000 records at home. Basically, nothing that's come out in the past 20 years of dance music, he does not have archived. So it's like, first of all, why are you wasting your time? Second of all, why aren't you concentrating? And third of all, I mean, it sounds like shit. Because most of the time, these people plug their Power Books into this club system, but they don't put anything in between them. If I go to do a live act with my computer, I have a compressor and an equalizer before my signal even goes to the desk, and there are compressors and equalizers. That's why most live gigs from a computer sound pretty good. But when you hear a DJ set from a computer, they don't even EQ the thing right. They just think, okay, for a vinyl, I put my bass in the middle and my mid-range in the middle, and the hi-hat, that must be how it's supposed to go. They plug in their computer, there's no bass, it's all middle and high-end, and it hurts your ears. And they don't think to change the EQing. That's why I don't like the system, because it's making people dumb. You know, they're making them lazy and dumb. They're not, because nobody researches anything. They go out, they buy it, they pull it out of the box, they plug it in, they're ready to go. No.
It's like I can do it with a CD.
Yeah.
So just what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, just
play. Yeah. They're jukeboxes with like, yeah. You know, they're biological jukeboxes. A bio box.
And could you remember the time when you became interested in dance halls?
Like I said, I've been doing dance music since I was 5 years old.
I know, but that time.
It wasn't anything in particular. I just liked music.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I didn't like about being a classical pianist was being apparently so good at such a young age that I was just upset with all the people that were in the audience because I thought none of them can play this well. So why do I have to play for them? That's where my first ideals about live performance and the unnecessity of it came from. That's why I love Chopin, because in his entire life, and he died at 38, 41, something like that. In his entire life, he did 300 performances or less. Chopin. And he was a legend in his time. So there's something to be said for that. You ain't got to be out there kissing the button on the stage now. Not all the time.
Yeah, but when you grew up, maybe was there something that made you interested in the audience or in the dance floor? Or in something, doing something for a specific audience? If you started with 13.
But no, there wasn't anything. There was this, I had a club when I was 15.
You had a club?
Mm-hmm.
But
21 and under.
Okay.
You couldn't get in if you were 21 or over.
You
could not come in the club if you were 21 or over.
Okay.
It was only for 21 and under. And it wasn't my club, I was just the main DJ there. And that was great because it was not, it was 81, 82, so it was no real, everything that was considered electronic, like Depeche Mode, that was all new. That was all brand new. All this stuff that's considered retro now was just coming out then. You know, and so for us, we were mixing that with industrial music and a fair bit of R&B, but not the R&B that they don't even write songs like what we're talking about now. The bands don't exist, 15-piece bands like Cameo and stuff like that. They don't run that kind of shit anymore. And the kind of thing is that the music, if it had the right tempo, nobody cared what the genre was. Because there was no this is proper club music or this isn't proper. They didn't know what proper club music was because clubbing was only 15 years old. By DJs traveling around to different places. That only started in the early 70s, really, in underground. Radio DJs had been doing it since radio began. But underground specialty DJs is what they were calling us. You have your fan base in your area and you stayed there. You might get to go to the next two or three counties or to some high school in a different state maybe to do a party for them, but for the most part you were in your direct Freundeskreis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the reason to come to Cologne? So from Domstedt you came first to Paris, then
I lived in Paris for a very long time. Actually, while I lived in Cologne, I still lived in Paris. I always had an apartment in both cities. And the only reason why I went to Cologne was to buy records. I was looking for underground house records, and I couldn't find anything underground in Paris at the time because the underground hadn't really started. This was 89. It was just coming up. They didn't have any new groove records. Strictly Rhythm was the closest thing to underground you could find. And so I heard that in Germany that there was a larger underground dance music scene. And so I wanted to come check it out, and Cologne was the closest place. So I just went to Cologne, and I ended up meeting Hans and Eustace on that trip. Mm-hmm. It was the first, I think it was the first, no, the first week, the first weekend I was in Cologne, I met everybody. Everybody I know today from there, that first day, that first Saturday. And Daniel Buchholz. Everybody, and Gregorio, everybody. Unbelievable. All in one day. They should have told me right then it was a small demographic. But yeah, Paris was, the inspiration for Paris was coming from Chopin, the direct influence of Chopin, because I studied pretty much, after I learned the first piece of Chopin, I wouldn't study any other pianist. I refused to study anything else except for Scott Joplin. And then I found out recently that Scott Joplin and Frédéric Chopin shared a piano instructor. Yeah, he outlived Chopin. I don't think he did not outlive Scott Joplin, but he outlived Chopin and ended up moving to the States and met Scott Joplin at the age of 11 and gave him private lessons because he thought he was a talent. And that was it, because I always thought that the music of Scott Joplin somehow picked up where the music of Chopin stopped after Chopin passed away. And there's only about 12 years or so in between their death and birth. And I was always trying to figure out how come this guy from somewhere near Texas sounds like this Austrian living in Paris 40 years before him. And my two piano instructors at the time as a teenager could not know about each other. One was for like jazz and gospel, and one was for classical. And they couldn't know about each other because they were both convinced that one medium or the other would destroy the other. So I couldn't play classical and then turn around and play, like, you know, ragtime, because that would destroy my hand for playing classical, which is complete bullshit, right? Because, I mean, now I find out from a classical pianist from Israel that Chopin and Scott Joplin had the same piano teacher. If either one of my piano teachers were alive right now, I would go slap both of them. They're lucky they're dead already. They're very lucky. But yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah?
Fun talk, yeah.
Thank you for having me. It was nice here.
Yeah, thank you.
I like it here. Thank you.